The repairing cell. Injury, decay, and constancy. Tenderness and rot share a border, and rot is an aggressive neighbor whose iridescence keeps creeping over. K. Ryan, 2007. Dan Worthley, an Australian postdoctoral researcher, came to my lab across many oceans, some physical and some metaphysical. He was a gastroenterologist by training, a subject that I knew very little about. He had come to Columbia University in New York to work with Tim Wang on colon cancer and the regeneration of colon cells. Wang, a professor at Columbia, is an old friend and collaborator, and to study colorectal cancer. Standard techniques of modern genetic engineering in mice now allow us to take a single gene and alter it, such that the protein it encodes is labeled with a fluorescent marker. The protein now becomes a glow-in-the-dark beacon. You can use a microscope to detect wherever or whenever the protein is physically present. Imagine if you did this for the cyclin genes that control the cell cycle. You would see the cell begin to glow as one particular cyclin protein was made and then disappear once that protein was degraded. If you took the same approach for the actin, the protein that makes up the skeleton of the cell, virtually the whole animal would become a glow-in-the-dark mouse. The T-cell receptor would only glow in T-cells. Insulin would glow in pancreatic cells. The glowing proteins, incidentally, come from jellyfish. Genetically speaking, a little bit of this mouse comes from a creature that wobbles and pulsates in the depths of an ocean. Worthley had genetically manipulated a mouse and engineered a gene, called Gremlin-1, using this technique. Whenever Gremlin-1 protein was made in a cell, that cell would become fluorescent and thereby visible by microscopy. Based on prior findings, Dan expected Gremlin-1 to come alight in cells in the colon. And true to form, he found it in a particular cell type in the colon. But some combination of innate curiosity and meticulousness had urged him to look for these Gremlin-1 labeled cells in other tissues. One place that the cells had lit up was in cells in the bone. And that's where our relationship began. If a catalog of neglected but vital human organs was ever compiled, or perhaps some ratio of the real-world importance to scientific neglect of an organ was enumerated, bone may well rank among the first in both lists. Medieval anatomists thought of bones as glorified hangers for the skin, or scaffolding for the body's innards, although Vesalius, bucking this trend, drew elaborate figures of skeletons. Several of his plates represent the detailed anatomies of various bones. At Massachusetts General Hospital, where I was a resident in the early 2000s, orthopedic residents jokingly, if wryly, called themselves boneheads. And who can forget the tragicomic soliloquy of Bonehead Bill from Robert Service's wartime poem, a soldier who is trained to maim and kill without thinking. Me job's to risk me life and limb, but be it wrong or right. Yet the skeleton turns out to represent one of the most elaborately complex of cellular systems. It grows to a point and then knows when to stop growing. It heals itself continuously throughout adult life and repairs itself acutely after injury. It responds with sensitivity to hormones. It potentially even synthesizes its own hormones. Research led by Gerard Carcenti and colleagues at Columbia has made the case that bone doesn't simply respond to hormones, but produces hormones. Early experiments show that one such protein, called osteocalcin, made by bone cells, appears to modulate sugar metabolism, brain development, and male fertility, although some of these findings still await confirmation. Its central cavities, the marrow, are the white-walled nurseries for the genesis of blood. It is the locus of osteoarthritis and osteoporosis, two of the major illnesses of aging, implicated in millions of deaths among the elderly around the world, and it is my personal nemesis. My father's fall, the fracture in his skull, and the bleeding that emanated from it was ultimately responsible for his death. But back to Dan and his bones. One morning, in the summer of 2014, Dan took the elevator down to my lab. His own lab was three floors above mine, with a box filled with bone slices. I could lie and say that I was instantly intrigued, but I wasn't. Researchers from all sorts of labs would descend on postdocs in my lab and on me, entreating us to look at their samples, asking if there was something interesting in the bones, and it was a constant sap on their and my time. I politely asked Dan to come another time. But Dan was unrelenting. Short, intense, energetic, and driven by a single purpose, he was like an Aussie-made hand grenade. He knew of my interest in bones. As an oncologist, I treat leukemia, a disease that originates in the bone marrow, where blood-forming stem cells live, and for decades, I've worked on how bone cells and blood cells interact. Why, for instance, aren't there blood stem cells in the brain or in the intestines? What is so special about bone? As a field, we've discovered some answers. Cells resident in the bone marrow send particular signals to blood stem cells that maintain their function. Over these years, I've also learned to understand the anatomy and physiology of bones. There's the now popular idea that you acquire a particular form of expertise when you've performed an activity, throwing a baseball, say, for more than 10,000 hours. In cell biology, it translates, well, into seeing. I have looked, through a microscope, at more than 10,000 specimens of bone. Scarcely had a week passed when Dan was back again, lurking in the corridors with the same combination of obsequiousness and determinedness, and with his blue box of slides. He was indifferent to my indifference. I sighed and decided to take a look. I darkened the room, and the microscope flickered on, sending a diffuse blue-green fluorescence across the room. Dan paced in the back of the room like a caged animal, muttering about gremlins. The slices were beautifully cut on a microtome, revealing the classic histology of bone. Superficially, bone might look like a chunk of hardened calcium, but it is, in fact, made of a multiplicity of cells. The most familiar are cartilage cells, technically called chondrocytes, and there are two unfamiliar-sounding cell types. The second is the osteoblast, the cell that deposits calcium and other proteins to form a calcified matrix and layers, and then get trapped in its own deposit to form new bone. It is the bone-making, bone-depositing cell. Typically, the osteoblasts thicken and lengthen the bone. My mnemonic for its name is the letter B for bone-making. The third is an osteoclast. These are large cells with multiple nuclei that are bone-eaters. They chew away on the matrix or punch holes in it, removing and remodeling bone like constantly pruning gardeners. I remember it because it contains the letter C for bone chewing. The dynamic balance between osteoblasts and osteoclasts, bone makers and bone chewers, is one mechanism by which bone maintains homeostasis. Take away osteoblasts and new bone cannot be laid down. Make osteoclasts, the bone chewers, defective, and the bone turns thick, stone bone, as early pathologists called it, tough-seeming but hard to repair. The cavities inside contract, crowding out space for the marrow, precipitating a disease called osteopetrosis. I have only cataloged the cells in the bone. There is a much vaster catalog of cells that reside in bone marrow. These include blood stem cells and blood progenitors. There are stromal cells that are thought to play a supportive role for blood stem cells. There are neurons and fat-storing cells, adipocytes, and cells of blood vessels, endothelial cells that bring blood into and out of the marrow. But bone doesn't just thin and thicken, it grows longer, and there's a cellular mystery in the growth of bone. We've met collections of cells that make organs grow larger, but how might collections of cells move directionally that makes an organ grow longer? Early anatomists, including Marie-Francoise Xavier Bichat, noted that bone begins in early development as a matrix of glutinous cartilage. Then it deposits calcium and hardens into the structure that we recognize as bone and begins to grow longer. But the main change in length occurs from the ends of the bones. The middle remains relatively constant. In the mid-1700s, the surgeon John Hunter hammered two screws into a growing adolescent bone. Their distance, he noted, was unchanged. But had he hammered the screws to the two ends of bone, he would have watched bone growing longer, the screws separating from each other in time, like two ends of an elastic band traveling farther and farther away as the band lengthens. In short, there are cells at the ends of a bone, but not in its middle, that generate new cells that lengthen it. There's a special place in the bone, just where its head, the fist-shaped end of long bones, meets the shaft. Somewhere at that junction, buried within the bone, there's a structure called a growth plate. If you roll your fingers into a fist and imagine your lower arm as the shaft of a long bone and the fist as its end, then the growth plate would sit somewhere near your wrist. The growth plate exists in children and adolescents. You can sometimes see it as a white line in an X-ray, but gradually closes in adults. You can imagine the growth plate as the kindergarten for young bone cells. It is the growth plate that gives rise to mature cartilage cells and to osteoblasts. The young cartilage cells, and then the bone-forming osteoblasts, shoot off the growth plate and migrate to the area adjacent to the head of the bone, depositing new matrix and calcium between the head and the shaft, which, in turn, lengthens the bone. And that is where Dan's slides came into play. The existence of the growth plate had been known for decades, but how was the bone's growth sustained, especially during that fierce burst of adolescence when a young man or woman might shoot up inch by inch every week? Fully mature cartilage, hypertrophic cartilage, we know doesn't grow or divide, so what cells were birthing bone cells week upon week? Was there a reservoir of skeletal cells that kept giving rise to the young cartilage cells and bone cells? The cells that Dan had lit up in his mouse sat precisely at the growth plate, in a neat, slightly curvilinear row, like a set of perfectly formed teeth. I looked and looked again. I was now massively intrigued. There's a moment in the life of a team of scientists, typically two researchers, when language disappears. Something akin to that moment passed between me and Dan. Language, or at least traditional language, vanished. We exchanged instincts. The pheromones of ideas passed between us, often wordlessly. At night, I would stay up late, pacing, thinking of the next experiment we should perform. The next morning, I would arrive at the lab to discover Dan had already done it. The first series of experiments were simple. What were these cells? Where did they live? During what period of time? Dan's first experiment had lit up gremlin-1 expressing cells in the growth plate of a young mouse. In a fetal mouse, he found them gathered brightly, precisely where new bone and cartilage were being formed. Imagine a tiny foot or a minuscule finger emerging. The cells were right there, dividing fiercely. And then, as he followed them further, an astonishing thing happened. The cells migrated from the tips of the neonatal bone to the growth plate, the part where the shaft meets the long bone, and organized themselves into a neat layer just at the growth plate. As the mouse grew older and the lengthening of bone was completed, the cells gradually grew fewer and fewer in number. Something about these cells, then, had to do with the formation of bone. But what, precisely? The molecular beacon that Dan had created has another special property. You can use the beacon to follow the fate of a cell as it divides. It takes some additional engineering, but you can ensure that when one cell makes the gremlin-1 protein, and thereby turns fluorescent, then its daughter cells will also become fluorescent, and the daughters of the daughters will also glow in the dark, and so forth, ad infinitum. The technique is called lineage tracing, as if you could somehow find every family member of an enormous family, even if they had dispersed in time and space. It is a molecular way of illuminating an entire family tree. Dan performed this experiment in a very young mouse, and when he traced gremlin-expressing cells, he found that they gave rise to young cartilage. That intrigued me. Cartilage-forming cells had always been a bit of a mystery, but as he looked at the tissue over longer and longer periods of time, the family tree got more complex. The cells to light up next were plump, bloated cells of mature cartilage. And then osteoblasts, bone-forming cells, began to light up. And finally, there was a totally unknown cell type, a cell with spindly fibers extending outward, whose function we don't yet know, that we called reticular cells. Perhaps most notably, the original gremlin-labeled cells, the ones that had come first, didn't go away, at least in young mice. In short, Dan had found that cell, the cell sitting in the growth plate, that gives rise to cartilage cells, which then matures into osteoblasts, the two principal components of bone. We call them osteo, bone, chondro, cartilage, and reticular cells, or ochre cells. Dan published his paper with me and Tim Wang in Cell in 2015. At the very same time, Chuck Chan, a brilliant postdoctoral researcher and now assistant professor working with Irv Weissman at Stanford, also discovered a skeletal stem cell. Rail thin and tall, Chan looks like a punk rocker. He comes to the lab as if he's been pulled out of an all-night rave. His experimental discipline, though, is unnerving. Chan, Weissman, and a surgeon-turned-scientist, Michael Longacre, had ground up bones and used Weissman's favorite technique, flow cytometry, to purify populations of skeletal cells that gave rise to cartilage and bone. Their paper came out with ours, back-to-back in the journal Cell. The similarities, genetic, physiological, histological, between our two cells was striking. For a while, we engaged in a friendly battle over how to name the cells, but ochre, which also happens to be a color that I particularly like, seems to have stuck. Dan's and Chuck's original papers also left a trail of questions. It's still unknown whether these gremlin-marked cells first give rise to young cartilage, an intermediate state, and then to osteoblasts, or do they give rise to both at the same time? Are there intrinsic or extrinsic factors that bias that decision? How is the balance, this homeostasis, maintained? And do these cells self-renew? Early results involving the transplantation of these cells into mouse bones do suggest that they renew themselves. Gremlin-marked cells, then, would fit the bill for true skeletal stem cells, capable of differentiating into multiple cell types and capable of self-renewal. The ochre cell, a putative skeletal progenitor or stem cell, might be the discovery that I and my lab are the proudest of. They represent a potential answer, a theory that solves two age-old mysteries. How does bone grow during adolescence? Well, because a special population of cells, sitting at the growth plate at the two ends of bone, shoots off cartilage and osteoblasts that allows bone to lengthen. And why does it stop growing? Because this population diminishes over time until early adulthood, when very few are left. But wait! The plot was to take yet another twist. In Texas, Sean Morrison, a former trainee of Weissman's and arguably the most tenacious stem cell biologist I know, found yet another cell type, resident inside the bone marrow, that could make osteoblasts and deposit bone. Unlike the gremlin-labeled cells, Morrison cells, call them LR cells for one gene that they express, are born later in adulthood and give rise, predominantly, to the bone that is deposited along the long shafts, not the growth plate, but the long tube of bone between the two plates. They don't give rise to cartilage cells or reticular cells. If you fracture the long shaft of bone, somewhere in the middle, the LR cells swing into action, generating bone-making cells that repair the injured long bone. What a mess, you might say, but it's quite the opposite. Bone is not just an organ with a single supply of rejuvenating cells, it is a chimera of rejuvenation. It has at least two sources for two sites. There are growth plate resident OCR, or ochre cells, which form lengthening bone. They arise early in development and then gradually decay with age. And there are LR cells that arise later in adolescence and adulthood that participate in the maintenance of thickness of long bones and bone fracture repair. Morrison's data, then, represent a potential solution to a third mystery. Why can bone thicken in adults and repair fractures when the growth plate has diminished and gone? Well, possibly because there's a reserve population of different cells, not resident in the growth plate, but inside the bone marrow that performs this function. The firstborn cells, such as the ones that Dan found, build and lengthen the bone during fetal life, and then assume a more limited role of maintaining the growth plate during adult life, we think. The later-born cells, the ones that Morrison found, march in like a second army that fixes fractures and maintains the integrity of the bone. This two-army solution uncouples the function of bone making and bone maintenance. Why two armies? We don't know. Dan returned to Australia in 2017, leaving me bereft. But then he lobbed another, much-appreciated hand grenade across the ocean. Zha Ying, short, intense, with Dan's concentrated energy and single-mindedness, came to the lab in 2017 to study the gremlin-marked cells. If Dan had asked the physiological question, how does bone and cartilage grow, Zha was interested in its pathological obverse. How does it decay? Osteoarthritis is a disease of cartilage degeneration. The old dogma ran that the constant grind between bones eats away at the lubricating lining of cartilage at the head of a bone, a femur, say. Cartilage cells at the joint surface die, and then the bone below the joint begins to wear away. And so Zha began to study mice with osteoarthritis using the techniques that Dan had pioneered in the lab. The first surprise concerned real estate. Location, location, location. We had been so blinkered by the skeletal stem cells sitting at the growth plate, birthing new cartilage and bone, that we had missed a second site where they were also located. When we looked again with new eyes, gremlin-labeled ochre cells were also present in a thin, veil-like layer just above the head of the bone. They sat glimmering, enticingly, at the joint where two bones meet, exactly where osteoarthritis originates. It would be hard to describe the exhilaration of the days that followed. I would swallow my cup of coffee in the mornings, pack my notebook, speed on the highway to the lab, and rush to the microscope room where Zha would have set out the slides from the previous night's cuts. She worked late, I worked early. The scope would turn on, and I would look and count. Seeing. Zha returned to Dan's experiment of lineage tracing, taking an indelible molecular tattoo and marking a cell, its daughters, its great-granddaughters, and so forth. And as with Dan's experiments, the result was a surprise. When she first labeled the cells, they were located in a thin veil-like layer right at the joint surface. And then, as the first weeks went by, they began to form layer upon layer of cartilage at the joint. In a month's time, we saw the appearance of bone cells below the cartilage. But what might happen to these cells during arthritis? We wrote a grant together proposing that the gremlin-marked stem cells, or ochre cells, would act as a regenerative reservoir. When mice got arthritis, we reasoned, the ochre cells would try to regenerate the lost cartilage, much like stem or progenitor cells act in other tissues when the tissue is depleted or injured. Osteoarthritis was the form frust, the frustrated form, of a tissue trying to repair itself but failing. In the lore of science, much has been written about the joy of being precisely right about a hypothesis or a theory. In the early 1900s, Einstein's proposal of the constancy of the speed of light would spectacularly validate earlier experimental observations made by Albert Michelson and Edward Morley. If the Michelson-Morley experiment had not brought us into serious embarrassment, no one would have regarded the relativity theory as a halfway redemption, Einstein would write later. But there's a second kind of joy in science, the peculiar exhilaration of being precisely wrong. It is an equal and opposite sensation of joy when an experiment proves a hypothesis wrong and the truth turns as if on a pivot to point exactly in the opposite direction. 3 weeks after Zha had introduced arthritis in the mice, there are many ways of achieving this, including using a mechanism to weaken one of the femoral joints. The induced injury is mild, and the mice almost always recover. We returned to the microscope to examine the bone slices. We had expected the ochre cells, lit up by the fluorescent protein, to be briskly proliferating, trying to buffer the injury. The same blue-green light flooded the room. See the images on the attached PDF. We had been precisely wrong. In young mice that had no induced injury, the expected layer of gremlin-marked ochre cells sat intact on the joint surface, the same glimmering line of cells. In injured mice, the cells, rather than becoming hyperactive and dividing to save the joint, as we had predicted, were dead or dying. The injury had killed the stem cells, to the point that they could no longer keep up the genesis of cartilage. This work is still being reviewed by scientists. I turned the microscope off, and an inner light flickered on. Osteoarthritis, perhaps, was a disease of stem cell loss. The cells that were being worn out in its first stages were the cartilage-making stem cells, and they could no longer keep up the genesis of cartilage. The balance between growth and degeneration had been disrupted. What the injury had thrown off was the capacity of cartilage at the joint to maintain its internal balance between the growth of new cartilage via the stem cells and the decay of old cartilage via age and injury. There were many, many experiments that followed to nail the point. Togrul Jafarov, a deliberative postdoc from Canada, picked up on Zha's work. Using remarkably dexterous techniques, he learned to forcibly kill the gremlin mark cells by injecting a chemical into the knee joint. In essence, Zha's experiment in reverse. If osteoarthritis originates in the death of gremlin-labeled cells, then does killing gremlin-labeled cells cause osteoarthritis? The mice, remarkably, developed osteoarthritis. Even young, healthy, mobile mice, otherwise normal, began to lose the integrity of the joint. They hobbled until the cells restarted the growth of cartilage. Jafarov kept pushing the direction of the experiments. He inactivated a gene that was crucial to the maintenance of gremlin-expressing cells and thereby killed the cells genetically. Again, the mice developed osteoarthritis, this time even more severe than any we had seen. I gasped when I saw these bones. There were sections of the bone in which the cartilage had eroded to the point that the end of the bone looked like a mountain that had been gashed by dynamite. The raw rocks of the bone below were exposed, naked, and crumbling. He purified gremlin-positive cells from animals, grew them in tissue culture, and transplanted them into mice. They divided, grew more gremlin-marked cells, albeit few in number, and then started making bone and cartilage all over again. He added a drug that would increase the number of gremlin-marked cells into the joint space. The mice were protected from osteoarthritis. Togrul, Zha, Dan, and I sent our data for publication in the winter of 2021. We proposed a radically new hypothesis about osteoarthritis. It isn't merely a degeneration of cartilage cells caused by grind and tear. It is, first, an imbalance caused by the death of gremlin-marked cartilage progenitor cells that cannot generate adequate bone and cartilage to keep up with the demands of the joint. And so we have a theory to answer the fourth age-old mystery. Why doesn't cartilage in joints get repaired, just as a bone fracture does in adults? Because the repairing cells die during the injury. Injury and repair share a border, except as we age, injury and the weariness of regenerative capacity keeps infiltrating, creeping over the hedge. Osteoarthritis is a degenerative disease that arises from a regenerative disease. It is a flaw in rejuvenative homeostasis. What general principle can one draw out of these experiments? One of the most unusual conundrums of cell biology is that while the early genesis of organs seems to follow a relatively ordered pattern, the maintenance and repair of tissues in adulthood seems idiosyncratic and peculiar to the tissue itself. The inner cell mass of the embryo, as I mentioned earlier, splits into three layers, followed by the formation of the notochord and the invaginations of the neural tube. The embryo is organized into various compartments, and the subsequent formation of organs along the body axis is governed by extrinsic signals that induce cells to adapt fates and intrinsic factors in cells that integrate these signals. If you cut the liver in half, the remnant liver cells will divide and grow the liver back to nearly its full size, even in adults. If you fracture a bone, osteoblasts will deposit new bone and repair the fracture, although the process slows down dramatically in older adults. But there are other organs where damage, once done, is permanent. Neurons in the brain and the spinal cord, once they've stopped dividing, don't divide to regenerate neurons. They are post-mitotic, that is, no longer able to divide. When certain kidney cells die, they don't come back. There are rare instances of neuronal regeneration documented in animals and humans. The vast proportions of neurons, though, never divide or regenerate after injury. Cartilage in the joints, as Dan, Zha, and Togrel discovered, sits somewhere in between. Fully mature cartilage cells in the joint are largely postmitotic in adult mice. But in young mice, there is a reservoir of cells that can generate cartilage. It diminishes radically with age and injury until it vanishes altogether. A recent paper by Henry Cronenberg and colleagues suggests that a fraction of mature cartilage cells can, given the right signals, wake up and start dividing again. Whether these cells are similar to the ones that Dan, Zha, and Togrel have found remains to be seen. It's as if every organ and every cell system has chosen its own kind of band-aid for repair and regeneration. Birds do it, bees do it, but they do it in ways and manners that are bird and bee, or liver and neuron, specific. Yes, there are some general principles. Organs have resident repair cells that can sense injury and aging. But the idiosyncrasies of repair in each organ suggest that the individual cellular band-aids were cobbled together and remain unique to every organ. To understand injury and repair, then, we have to do it organ by organ and cell by cell. Or perhaps there's a general principle of repair that we are still missing, akin to the general principles of cell biology that researchers have found in other systems of cells. In cell biological terms, then, it might be easier to imagine injury, or aging for that matter, more abstractly as a furious battle between a rate of decay and a rate of repair, with each rate unique for every individual cell and individual organ. In some organs, injury overwhelms repair. In some organs, repair keeps apace with injury. In yet other organs, there's a delicate equilibrium between one rate and another. The body, in its steady state, seems to be maintained, suspended, in constancy. Don't just do something, stand there. But standing there, standing still, is not a stasis, but a frenetically active process. What appears as stillness, stasis, is in fact a dynamic war between these two competing rates. At death you break up, Philip Larkin wrote. The bits that were you start speeding away from each other forever, with no one to see. But death isn't a flying apart of organs. It is the withering grind of injury set against the ecstasy of healing. Tenderness, as Ryan puts it, combating rot. The central corporals in this pitch battle are cells. Cells dying in tissues and organs, and cells regenerating tissues and organs. Return for a moment to the notion of homeostasis, the maintenance of a constancy in the internal milieu. We first evoked this idea to understand how the cell maintains its internal fixity. We then used it to understand how a healthy body adjusts to metabolic and environmental changes, salt load, waste disposal, sugar metabolism. We apply it now to the maintenance of balance between injury and repair. Death, the most absolute of absolutes, is, in fact, a relative balance between forces of decay and rejuvenation. If you tip the balance in one direction, when the rate of injury overwhelms the rate of recovery or regeneration, you fall off the edge. The osprey, buffeted by the changing winds, cannot remain suspended in midair. The selfish cell, the ecological equation, and cancer. Those who have not trained in chemistry or medicine may not realize how difficult the problem of cancer really is. It is almost, not quite, but almost, as hard as finding some agent that will dissolve away the left ear, say, and leave the right ear unharmed. William Waglum, 1947. We return, in the end, full circle, to the cell capable of infinite rebirth, the cancer cell. Of course, there is no such thing as a singular cancer cell. Cancer is a diverse group of diseases, and even a single cancer can have multiple types of cells. What I've tried to do here is to distill some general principles shared by most cancer cells. Later, we will more clearly encounter how cancer cells differ from each other, even within one patient. No cell's birth or rebirth has been studied as intensely or as passionately. And yet, despite decades of investigation, our attempts to thwart both the birth and rebirth of cancer have themselves been thwarted. Some features of the nature and the mechanisms of cancer's origin, regeneration, and spread have become clear. Much, though, still remains mystifying. To understand the malignant division of a cancer cell, we might begin with the division of normal cells. Consider a cut in your hand. We might describe the response to the cut as a cascade of cellular events that restores the status of a tissue after injury, homeostasis at work. Blood leaks out. Platelets and clotting factors induced by the tissue damage gather around the wound. Neutrophils, sensing a danger signal, accumulate at the site as first responders to infection. They stand guard to ensure that pathogens don't get a chance to breach the boundaries of the self. A clot forms, and the wound is temporarily plugged. And then healing begins. If the wound is shallow, the two ends of skin oppose against themselves. If the wound is deep, fibroblasts from under the skin, the spindle-shaped cells that exist in virtually every tissue, crawl in to deposit a protein matrix underneath the wound, and then skin cells proliferate over the matrix to cover the wound, occasionally leaving a scar. Once they touch each other, the cells stop dividing. It takes a host of cells to coordinate this process. The wound has healed. But here's the cell biological conundrum. What makes the skin cells start growing? And more pertinently for cancer, what makes them stop? Each time we cut ourselves, why don't we grow a new appendage, like a tree growing a branch? Part of the answer takes us back to the beginning of this audiobook, to the genes that Hunt, Hartwell, and Nurse discovered that control the division of cells. When the cut occurs, signals from the wound and from the cells that respond to it, intrinsic and extrinsic cues, activate a cascade of genes to make the repairing cells begin dividing. And when the healing is complete and the skin cells touch each other, another set of signals inform the cells to exit the cycle. You might imagine these signals as accelerators and brakes in a car. When the road is wide open, immediately after the injury, the car accelerates. But when the traffic thickens, cell division gradually slows to a stop. This is regulated cell division, and it happens many millions of times every day in every human body. It is the basis of the development of an organism from a single cell. Why don't some embryos explode to 20 times their size? That is the basis for embryogenesis. Why don't we grow new limbs every time we get a cut? It is the basis for the continuous repair and regeneration of an organ. Why did Nancy Lowry, transplanted with her sister's cells, not burst with blood? That is the basis of our understanding of how blood stem cells make new progenitors but seemingly stop when normal blood counts have been restored. But cancer is, in a sense, a disorder of internal homeostasis. Its hallmark is that cell division is dysregulated. The genes that control these accelerators and brakes are broken, that is, mutated, such that proteins that they encode, the regulators of cell division, no longer function in their appropriate contexts. The accelerators are permanently jammed, or the brakes fail permanently. More typically, it is a combination of both events, jammed accelerator genes and snapped brakes, that drives the dysfunctional growth of a cancer cell. The cars speed through the traffic jam, piling up on each other and causing tumors, or they frantically move into alternate routes, causing metastasis. I don't mean to give cancer cells personalities. This is a Darwinian process requiring natural selection. The cells that succeed are the fittest for survival. They are naturally selected to be the cells most adapted to grow and divide in circumstances where they do not belong and in tissues where they do not belong. Natural selection creates cells that disobey every law of belonging, except for the laws that they have created for themselves. As I described before, the malfunctions in the accelerator or brakes genes are caused by mutations, changes in DNA, and therefore changes in proteins that dysregulate their function so that they are typically permanently on or permanently off. The jammed accelerators are called oncogenes. The snapped brakes are called tumor suppressors. Most of these cancer-causing genes are not genes that directly command the cell cycle, although some are. Rather, many of them are the commanders of the commanders. They recruit other proteins that further recruit others until a malignant cascade of protein signals within a cell ultimately whips the cell into a kind of mitotic frenzy to keep dividing without control. Cells pile on cells, invading tissues where they do not belong. They break the laws of cellular civility, of citizenship. Beyond controlling cell division, many of these genes have diverse functions, activating or repressing the expression of other genes. Some of the genes co-opt the metabolism of the cell, enabling it to use nutrients to drive the malignant rebirth of the cancer cell. Some of them alter the normal inhibition that cells achieve once they contact each other. Cancer cells heap on each other even when normal cells would stop dividing. One astonishing feature of cancer is that any individual specimen of cancer has a permutation of mutations that is unique to it. One woman's breast cancer can have mutations in, say, 32 genes. The second woman's breast cancer can have 63, with only 12 overlapping between the two. The histological or cellular appearance of two breast cancers may look identical under the pathologist's microscope, but the two cancers may be genetically different. They behave differently and may require radically different therapies. Indeed, this heterogeneity of mutational fingerprints, the set of mutations carried by an individual cancer cell, reaches down to the individual cell level. The woman's breast tumor, which contained 32 mutations in its bulk, it may have an individual cancer cell that has 12 of the 32 mutations, and sitting just adjacent to it, a cell with 16 of the 32, with some overlapping and some not. Even a single breast tumor, then, is actually a collage of mutant cells, an assemblage of non-identical diseases. We still don't have simple methods to understand which of these mutations is driving the pathological features of the tumor, driver mutations, and which are just encrusted on DNA as a consequence of the tumor-gathering mutations as it divides, passenger mutations. Some, such as CMYC, are so common across multiple cancers that they are almost certain to be drivers. Others are unique to particular forms of cancer, to leukemia, or a particular variant of lymphoma. For some mutant genes, we understand how they enable dysregulated malignant growth. For some, we don't yet know. When I went to meet Sam P. in the hospital in May 2018, I was asked to wait outside. He was nauseated and excused himself to use the bathroom. He composed himself, and a nurse helped him back to bed. It was nearing twilight, and he turned a bed lamp on. He asked the nurse if we might speak alone. "It's over, isn't it?" he said, looking straight at my face, his brain boring a direct hole into the core of my brain. "Be honest," he said. Was it really over? I mulled over the question. Here we had the strangest of cases. Some of his tumors were responding to the immunotherapy, while others remained obdurately recalcitrant. And every time we increased the dose of the immune drugs, an autoimmune hepatitis, horror autotoxicus of the liver, would push us back. It was as if each individual metastatic tumor had acquired its own program of rebirth and resistance, each battening down in its own niche in his body, each behaving as if it were an independent community of colonists trapped in its own island. We were fighting on multiple fronts at the same time, winning some, losing others. And every time we applied an evolutionary pressure on the cancer, an immunotherapeutic drug, say, some cell escaped the pressure and set up a new recalcitrant colony again. I told him the truth. "I don't know," I said. "And I will not know right till the very end." The nurse came in again to change the beeping IV line, and we changed the subject. One rule of cancer that I've learned is that it is like a fixated interrogator. It does not allow you to change subjects, even when you think you can. Months ago, while he had been working at the paper, I had watched him and a bunch of his friends put together a playlist of music. I had borrowed the playlist for a party I was hosting. It had turned out to be my favorite set of songs. "What are you listening to now?" I asked. For a while, the emollients of casual small talk soothed the tension, and a sense of normalcy descended on the room. Two guys talking about playlists, rock and roll, hip-hop, rap. We spoke for another hour, and then it was as if I had reached a place where the unavoidable questions could no longer be avoided. The fixated interrogator was back. "Any advice, Doc?" he asked. "What happens at the end?" What happens at the end? It's a question both ancient and unanswerable. I reached back to think about patients who had fought his kind of amorphous battle. Winning, losing, winning. To think of what they had needed in their final weeks. I asked him to think of three things he could achieve. Forgive someone, be forgiven by someone, and tell someone that he loves them. Some truth had moved between us. It was as if he had understood why I'd come to see him. He was caught off guard by another wave of nausea. The nurse was called in and brought a basin. "Till next time," he said. "Next week?" "Till next time," I said firmly. I never saw Sam again. He died that week. I don't believe in rebirth, but some Hindus, among others, do. The peculiar thing about the rebirth of a cancer cell is that the genetic programs that enable cancer cells to sustain malignant growth are shared, to some extent, with stem cells. If you look at genes turned on and off in leukemia stem cells, say, there is a striking overlap of that subset of genes with normal blood stem cells, making it, yet again, nearly impossible to find a drug that will kill cancer but spare stem cells. If you look at genes turned on and off in bone cancer cells, you find a similar subset of genes turned on and off in skeletal stem cells. And the overlaps continue. Among the four genes that Shinya Yamanaka had turned on to transform normal cells into embryonic stem-like cells, the iPS cells that won him the Nobel Prize, there is one called CMYC, the very gene which, when dysregulated, becomes one of the main drivers of multiple forms of cancer. The relationship between cancer and stem cells, in short, is turning out to be far too uncomfortably close. This begs two important questions. First, do stem cells turn cancerous? And conversely, does the population of cancer cells within the body have a subpopulation of cells within it that is responsible for cancer's continuous regeneration, just as blood and bones have reservoirs of stem cells within them? Is that the secret to cancer's continuous regrowth? A secret, specialized subpopulation of cells that acts as its regenerative reservoir? The first is a question of origin. Where do cancer cells come from? The second is the question of regeneration. Why do malignant cells keep growing while other cells have controlled, restricted growth? These questions continue to fuel fierce debates among oncologists and cancer biologists. Take the first question. Stem cells, or their immediate descendants, can certainly be made to turn cancerous in model systems. Researchers working with blood have shown that the introduction of a single gene into a mouse's blood stem cell descendant can create a lethal leukemia. That gene, in fact, a mutation that creates a fusion between two genes, encodes a many-fingered protein that can turn such a plethora of genes on and off, in cascade after cascade, that it can drive a stem cell toward an aggressive leukemia. Further mutations also accumulate as the cell progresses toward the leukemia. But the converse is much harder to achieve. Can you take a fully mature, differentiated cell, a perfectly good citizen cell, and make it into a malignant actor? Yes, you can, but with a lot of genetic shoving. That is, by adding a gamut of extremely powerful cancer-goading genetic signals to the cell. Remember the glial cells that we met as accessories to the nervous system? They are fully mature. They don't grow uncontrollably. In a study performed in 2002, scientists led by Ron DePinho, then at Harvard and now in Texas, took one such mature glial cell in a mouse, expressed powerful cancer-causing genes in it, and transformed it into a glioblastoma, a lethal brain tumor. Does the phenomena happen in real life? We don't know. What about the second question? do cancers have stem cells that act as a reservoir to keep them growing indefinitely? In Toronto, John Dick's group has demonstrated that a tiny fraction of the bulk of leukemia cells in the marrow are capable of regenerating the whole leukemia from scratch, just as a rare population of blood cells can repopulate blood. Dick has termed these leukemia stem cells. In other words, in some cancers, there is a hierarchy in which a small subset of cancer cells is uniquely capable of proliferating extensively and driving disease progression, while the rest of the cancer cells have little or no capacity to proliferate. These cancer stem cells are like the roots of an invasive plant. You cannot remove the plant without removing the roots, and by the same logic, you cannot kill the cancer without killing the cancer stem cells. But the theory that all cancers have stem cells has its challengers. In Texas, Sean Morrison has argued that the cancer stem cell model is not relevant to some cancers like melanoma, where most cells are capable of proliferating extensively and contributing to disease progression. The cells retain the ability to proliferate extensively, possessing stem-like properties. For these cancers, therapies must eliminate as many cancer cells as possible to have a chance of succeeding. And there may be yet other cancers in which adherence to the cancer stem cell model varies from patient to patient. For example, in some breast cancers and brain tumors, there might be cancer stem cells and non-stem cells, while in other breast and brain cancers, there may be no such hierarchy. The normal laws of physiology of stem cells don't apply because of the immense fluidity that cancer cells can accomplish by just flicking the switches of some genes. To be clear, cancer cells don't possess sentience or a brain that makes them flick switches on and off. It is evolution that selects for the cells that have turned on certain genes that enable continuous regrowth. "Look," Morrison told me, "this is all going to become more complicated. Some cancers, including myeloid leukemias, really do follow a cancer stem cell model, but in some other cancers, there is no meaningful hierarchy, and it will not be possible to cure a patient by targeting a rare subpopulation of cells. The field has a lot of work to do to figure out which cancers, or even which patients, fall in each category." This much, though, is certain. Some cancer cells and stem cells reprogram the cell in profound ways. Genes are turned on and off inside the cells to enable their continuous rebirth. The difference is that in cancer, the program is perpetually locked, because the fixity of its mutations doesn't allow the cell to change its program of continuous division. In normal, healthy stem cells, the program is malleable, because the cell can differentiate into osteoblasts or cartilage cells or red blood cells and neutrophils. Stem cells can change the programs of identity. As I said before, they balance selfishness, self-renewal, with self-sacrifice, differentiation. The cancer cell, in contrast, is trapped, imprisoned in a program of perpetual rebirth. It is the ultimate selfish cell. Worse, if you apply an evolutionary pressure, a medicine to target a particular gene, there's enough heterogeneity and fluidity in cancer cells that allows them to select a different gene program to resist the medicine. A cell with a resistant mutation can grow out. A cell with a slightly altered genetic program, this is what I meant by the fluidity of cancer's genetic program, a cell in a different metastatic site, beyond the drug's reach, can activate a new genetic program to resist being detected and eliminated. For the last few decades, we've tried to target specific genes or specific mutations in cancer cells to try to attack cancer. Some of them have been remarkable successes. Herceptin, for instance, for HER2-positive breast cancer, or Gleevec for a kind of leukemia called CML. But trials of other gene-targeted mutations, personalized cancer medicine, have proved more modestly successful or have failed altogether, partly because the cells acquire resistance, partly because of the heterogeneity of cancer cells, partly because the commonalities between cancer cells and normal cells, particularly stem cells, puts a natural ceiling on the drug before the medicine becomes toxic to the body. It is cell biology's version of what Kant might have called the terrifying sublime. As I left Sam's room in the hospital, I thought of his playlist. Imagine that all the genes in the cells, the entirety of its genome, is a fixed, pre-selected playlist. Stem cells can choose which songs to play and in what order as they change from self-renewal to differentiation. When they self-renew, they play a certain set. When they differentiate, they play a different set. In cancer, the fixity of mutations won't allow the order of the songs to change. The accelerators are stuck in the on position and the brakes stuck in the off position. Consequently, unlike with normal stem cells, the body has little capacity to regulate their activity. The playlist is set. The same series of songs get played over and over like a malevolent tune that one cannot get out of one's head. And when you apply a selective pressure, such as a drug or immunotherapy, it switches to a new list of genes or even scrambles the songs, remixing a crazed jumble of hip-hop and Chopin, say, in its playlist, such that malignant cells can escape the drug and then repeat. Now the cancer cell has a new, fixed malignant tune that it cannot get out of its head. When the comprehensive list of genes that drive the growth of cancer cells were first identified in the mid-2000s, there was an exuberance that we had unlocked the key to cures for cancer. You have a leukemia that has mutations in TET2, DNMT3A, and SF3B1, I would tell a bewildered patient. I would look at her triumphantly as if I'd solved the Sunday crossword puzzle. She would look at me as if I was from Mars. And then she would ask the simplest question, "So, does that mean that you know the drugs that are going to cure me?" "Yes, soon," I would say, with exuberance. For the linear narrative ran thus: isolate the cancer cells, find the altered genes, match it with medicines that target those genes, and kill the cancer without harming the host. And so researchers ran two kinds of trials to prove this idea right. How could it not be right? The first, called basket trials, would put different cancers, lung, breast, melanoma, that happened to share the same mutations into the same basket and treat them with the same drug. After all, same mutation, same drug, same basket, same responsiveness, no? The results were sobering. In one landmark study published in 2015, 122 patients with several different types of cancer, lung, colon, thyroid, were found to have the same mutation in common, and thus were treated with the same drug, vemurafenib. The drug worked in some cancers. There was a 42% response rate in lung cancer, but not at all in others. For example, colon cancer had a 0% response rate, and even most of the responses did not last, landing patients back at square one after a fleeting remission. The second kind of trial was the obverse, an umbrella trial. Here, one kind of cancer, say lung cancer, was checked for different mutations, and each lung cancer with a particular mutational set was put under a different umbrella. Each individual lung cancer under its own umbrella was given a different set of drugs specific for its particular combination of mutations. After all, different mutations, different umbrellas, different therapies, and therefore specific responses. No? It didn't work either. A major trial called Battle 2 also generated sobering data, and most of the cancers hardly responded. Ultimately, one reviewer commented dejectedly, the trial failed to identify any new promising treatments. We biomedical scientists are addicted to data like alcoholics are addicted to cheap booze, Michael Yaffe, a cancer biologist from MIT, wrote in the journal Science Signaling. As in the old joke about the drunk looking under the lamppost for his lost wallet, biomedical scientists tend to look under the sequencing lamppost where the light is brightest, because that's where it's easiest to see. That is, where the most data can be obtained as quickly as possible. Like data junkies, we continue to look to genome sequencing when the really clinically useful information may lie someplace else. Sequencing is seduction. It is data, not knowledge. So where is the really clinically useful information sitting? Somewhere, I believe, in an intersection between the mutations that the cancer cell carries and the identity of the cell itself. The context. The type of cell it is, lung, liver, pancreas, the place where it lives and grows, its embryonic origin and its developmental pathway. the particular factors that give the cell its unique identity, the nutrients that give it sustenance, the neighboring cells on which it depends. Perhaps a new generation of cancer therapies will get us over this addiction. For decades, we have imagined cancer as the consequence of an individual malignant cell. The cancer cell has turned into an icon of the malignant behavior of the disease, of cellular autonomy gone rogue. There is even a scientific journal called Cancer Cell. The cancer cell has become the locus of our attention. Kill the cell and we defeat cancer. This tumor is invading the brain, one surgeon says to another in an operating room. By contrast, whoever says that the cold catches you? Subject, verb, object. Cancer is the autonomous actor, the aggressor, the mover. The host, the patient, is the hush audience member, the afflicted victim, the passive onlooker. The context she provides, the particular behavior of her cancer cells, their location, their slippery mobility, her immune response to it, why would any of this matter? But in Sam's case, each metastatic site of cancer behaved differently. His body was far from a passive onlooker. The behavior of the metastasis in his liver was not the behavior in the outer lobe of his ear, and some of his organs were mystifyingly spared while others were densely colonized. The question gets to the heart of what makes cancer metastasis survive in some places, while other sites, the kidney and spleen notably, never seem to attract metastasis. Perhaps cancer cells, like organs and organisms, should also be imagined as a community. And that, too, a community that can only take up residence in a particular place and at a particular time. The metaphors of cancer are changing. Cancer as a cooperative assembly. Cancer as an ecology gone wrong. Cancer as a malevolent pact between a rogue cell and the environment which it co-opts. An armistice between the cell and the tissue in which it can flourish. Cancer is no more a disease of cells than a traffic jam is a disease of cars, the British physician and cancer researcher D.W. Smithers wrote in The Lancet in 1962. A traffic jam is due to a failure of the normal relationship between driven cars and their environment and can occur whether they themselves are running normally or not. Smithers had overstepped in his provocation. The uproar that ensued was clamorous and immediate. Bob Weinberg, one of the most influential cancer researchers, told me that it was utter nonsense. But Smithers, pushing provocation to be sure, was trying to focus attention away from the cancer cell to the behaviors of these cells in their real environments. And so, we are inventing new metaphors for the disease. Forget mutations. Attack metabolism. Some cancer cells, for instance, become highly dependent on, addicted to is the medical jargon, particular nutrients and particular metabolic pathways. In the 1920s, the German physiologist Otto Warburg discovered that many cancer cells use a fast and cheap method of glucose consumption to generate energy. Malignant cells prefer oxygen-free fermentation rather than the deep, slow burn that we had encountered in mitochondria, even when there is plentiful oxygen. Normal cells, in contrast, almost always use a combination of slow and fast burn, oxygen-dependent and independent mechanisms to generate energy. What if this unique metabolic quirk of malignant cells could be used to drive an inroad to killing cancer? No one knows why cancer cells prefer this fast and cheap but highly inefficient mechanism of producing energy. After all, oxygen-dependent respiration, aerobic respiration, generates 36 molecules of ATP, while oxygen-independent fermentation, anaerobic respiration, generates only two such molecules, an 18-fold difference. Why would a cancer cell use an inefficient energy-generating system when much more energy could be extracted and resources were not limiting? A leukemia cell, for instance, is literally bathed in blood. There are enough nutrients and oxygen to use aerobic respiration. Part of the answer may lie in the fact that the use of oxygen-dependent reactions to generate energy create toxic byproducts, highly reactive chemicals that are harmful to cells that then need to be dispensed and cleansed. Toxic byproducts of oxygen-dependent respiration include chemicals that induce mutations in DNA, which, in turn, activate an apparatus in cells to stop dividing. Remember the G2 checkpoint, when cells check to ensure the quality of its DNA? Cancer cells may have evolved to make the best of it, in essence, sacrificing energy efficiency to keep away from these toxic byproducts. This is one of many hypotheses. Others have argued for other reasons for the preference of cancer cells for fermentation. Recent work from some researchers, such as Ralph de Borodinas, has shown that the Warburg effect, that is, the cancer cell's use of the non-mitochondrial pathway to generate energy, may be exaggerated by the artificial conditions that we use to grow cancer cells in the lab compared to how they grow in the real body. When we culture cancer cells in the lab, we typically add very high levels of glucose to the culture, and this may shift metabolism toward the non-mitochondrial pathway. This said, the Warburg effect is still real. Some real cancers growing in humans, not in the lab, use the non-mitochondrial pathway as their major mechanism to generate energy, but we may have overestimated the extent of the effect. Another clinical trial that my group is running with a team from Cornell University and with Lou Cantley, now at Harvard, hopes to pursue the unnervingly universal way that cancers depend on sugar or protein metabolism that is different from normal cells. Working with Cantley, we've discovered that some, but not all, cancers use insulin, whose release is prompted by glucose, as a mechanism of resistance to an otherwise potent anti-cancer drug. In other words, cancer cells are, indeed, toxified by this drug, except, like wily criminals, they learn to use insulin to circumvent the drug's toxicity. Which raises the question of the unique dependence of cancer cells, mutations aside, on some particular nutrients. If we disabled the particular ways cancer cells use nutrients and then unleash drugs on the malignant cells, would they finally become resensitized to the drug? Or deplete the body of proline, an amino acid that some cancers are addicted to, and thereby choke them nutritionally? Or concentrate on the evasion of immunity? Jim Allison and Tatsuku Hanjo use the idea that all cancers must, at some point, find ways of resisting the immune system. Uncloak cancer's cloak, and you have a therapy that doesn't seem to depend on the immune system. Starve cancer's blood vessels, an idea championed by the researcher Judah Folkman in the 1990s. Create engineered T-cells a la Emily Whitehead to attack her leukemia. But first, understand the cancer cell's physiology. As a cell, in the context that it grows, the way we understand every other cell. The organ it lives in, the supportive cells it surrounds itself with, the signals it sends, the dependencies and vulnerabilities that it possesses. There are mysteries beyond mysteries. Engineered T cells are potently active against leukemias and lymphomas, but fail against ovarian and breast cancer. Why? The kind of immunotherapy used in Sam's case eliminated the tumors in his skin, but not in his lungs. Why? As one of my own postdoctoral researchers discovered, our method of insulin depletion, via diet, decelerated endometrial and pancreatic cancers, but accelerated the development of some leukemias in mice. Why? We don't know what we don't know. Given this chapter's focus on the cancer cell, its behavior, migration, and metabolism, I have consciously chosen not to address cancer prevention and early detection. Some of these topics were covered in my earlier book, The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. And more recent advances in prevention and early detection will be updated in a future edition.